This morning, in the first hour of the show, we will look back to the year 1968. And our guest is Mark Kurlansky. He is the author of a recently published book, which is titled 1968, The Year That Rocked the World, and it's published by Ballantine. And the very first line of his introduction goes like this: there has never been a year like 1968, and it is unlikely there will ever be one again. That seems like a rather sweeping statement, but when you start to catalog all of the events of 1968, it appears to be perhaps something of an understatement. 1968 was the year both when Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were assassinated. It was the year of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago and the student demonstrations that went with it. It was the year of the Prague Spring, of the anti-war movement, the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. It was the time of the beginning of the women's movement and also the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union. And the question that we will explore this morning is, in what ways, if any, are these events related? Why is it that so many momentous events took place in 1968? That's what it is he explores in the book. As we talk, of course, questions and comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief, so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone listening is welcome to call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. Mark Kurlansky began his career as a foreign correspondent, writing about the last years of Francoism in Spain, especially in the Basque provinces. For 25 years, he's reported on international affairs from the Caribbean, Paris, and Mexico. He's also written extensively about Europe and Latin America. He's been a regular contributor to the Partisan Review. He's also written for the International Herald Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, Harper's, and New York Times Magazine, among other publications. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Kurlansky, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. What in a moment we can go and talk in greater detail, and in the book that you talk about, basically four things that were very important at this time and also ties people in different parts of the country and different parts of the world together. But before that, I guess I'm interested in what it was that drew your interest to this project and concentrating on this one year.
Well, it's something I've been thinking about for a very long time. I guess since 1968. What was it? Why did it happen? What did it mean? Where did it go? A very complex and difficult thing to understand. I first talked to my editor about this book. I have the good fortune to have an editor that I've worked on something like 11 books with the same editor. We first started talking about this book over 10 years ago. It's a very unusual phenomena in history, in a moment that was on the cusp of huge changes in the world. And at the time, there was a sense we all had that we were on the cusp of huge changes in the world, but they were very different than what we imagined. And so it took me some time to really kind of understand what had happened.
Where were you in 1968, or what were you doing in 1968?
I was a student in Indianapolis, and very much opposed to the Vietnam War, and demonstrated, and I guess probably a typical 1968 student. Hmm.
You explain in the book, make the argument that there were four things, four big things, that themselves were related, and then one way or another helped to make connections between movements and people in different places. And
right.
Probably the thing, I would think that the thing that would loom largest in a lot of people's minds would be the Vietnam War.
Yeah, it was the... the bloodiest year of the Vietnam War. 15,000 Americans died in Vietnam in that year alone. And the war was extremely unpopular around the world. It was still the age of decolonialization when lots of new countries were being formed in Africa and Asia and the Caribbean and Latin America, breaking away from colonial rulers and forming new countries. And to almost everybody in the world except the United States government, that's what Vietnam was, a former colony struggling for its independence. To the U.S. government, it was a domino in the Soviet communist conspiracy to take over the world. But nobody else saw it that way. And people were quite angry about the war. And it served as a kind of a rallying point. So that in a lot of countries such as Germany and France and Mexico, to begin with, movements on local issues were very small, but you could get large crowds for demonstrations against the American war in Vietnam. It's also true that in the U.S., at a time when the civil rights movement had become very splintered between Martin Luther King and his tactics of nonviolence and the Black Power movement, the one thing that everybody in civil rights could still agree on was opposition to the war in Vietnam. So it was, in a sense, a unifying factor of opposition movements.
I think it's probably important to make the connection with the civil rights movement, as you do, because a lot of people who were involved in the movement to protest the Vietnam War, at least some of them, had experience working in the civil rights movement, and I think that they use that movement, the civil rights movement, as a kind of a template to design the movement to protest the war. So there's
absolutely
a connection there.
It was, all of the important student leaders, in SDS and the free speech movement and all these things were people who had experience, Abby Hoffman, they'd all had experience in the civil rights movement. And a lot had come out of the Freedom Summer, Mississippi Freedom Summer of 1964, when they went south to register black voters. But even more than that, all over the world, the civil rights movement, which had been going on for more than 10 years by 1968, was something that had been seen and very well covered and very much admired. And protest was in the air, demonstrating for things, having sit-ins, so that many movements began over fairly small issues. The first student demonstrations in Prague were over bad lighting in dormitories, and the French student movement started over coeducational dormitories. And there was the sense that if there was something that you wanted to make a point about, you would do what the civil rights workers did. You would have marches and sit-ins. And that was a starting point that often grew because of repression. It's remarkable how all over the world, these very small marches and movements, were attacked by police, and then the issue became police brutality, and it grew from there. Mm.
Evelyn mentioned, or at least I think I mentioned, that this 1968 was the year of the Tet Offensive, and this was a time when I think that the United States government and people in the military were trying to make the argument, and perhaps some people believe them, that this was a war that could be won. And Tet, I think one of the things that it did was it offered a different sort of some different a viewpoint on the war.
Well, it's not only that it could be won, but that we were winning yeah. it. And suddenly there's Viet Cong attacking inside the U.S. Embassy and attacking all of the hearts of all these cities. And although they lost all of these battles, the attack of the U.S. Embassy was basically a suicide mission. How come they had this ability to do these attacks? We had been told that the war was about to end, that it was at a turning point, that they were almost defeated, and clearly they weren't. But also, just the fact of it being on television was extraordinary. Seeing live warfare, seeing that day's battle in the evening, nobody had ever experienced anything like that. It had a huge impact. The thing about war is the more people can see of war, the less they're going to like it.
Yeah. Well, that is the third of your four things. That is the kind of media coverage that now perhaps we're used to, but didn't really exist so much before that time. Where,
right. There were two crucial inventions. One was live satellite transmissions, the first live transmission had been in 1958, but for quite a few years it was not very useful because you could only broadcast from a certain point at a certain hour when the satellite was in the right position, so that Daniel Shore told me this story when he used to work for CBS, that they discovered that the satellite was in the right position for a broadcast from Berlin at midnight to broadcast live on the Cronkite show. So they had him stand in front of the Berlin Wall. And, there's absolutely nothing going on at the Berlin Wall at midnight. And he's just standing there in the dark, and, the lights come on him, and he says, "Oh, you heard that dog barking? That could be a dog barking at somebody running for freedom or not. We don't know." He had absolutely nothing to say because there was nothing going on. But there was this kind of excitement that it was live from Berlin. But by 1968, satellites were what they called geostationary. They could fix their position relative to the Earth, and you could, they had enough of them set up well enough so that you could broadcast from most places at most times, and it became a practical tool. The other thing was, during the 60s, there was the transition from film to videotape, which is much cheaper, but also doesn't need to be processed, so you can just shoot it and then broadcast it, so you have the instant rebroadcast, which is what the Chicago Convention was. They filmed 17 minutes of Chicago police clubbing demonstrators and broadcast it while the clubbing was still going on. That's why today, of the many demonstrations and many instances of police violence, the one that we most remember is Chicago, because it was broadcast instantly on television around the world. And you have to remember that in 1968, people were not accustomed to TV being immediate like that, and it had an impact that's almost unimaginable today. And I doubt that, technology will ever have as great an impact as that had. We now live in a world where we're used to technology changing our life and our perceptions. We're all using technology that we hadn't even thought of 5 years ago, and we accept the fact that, 2 years from now, something new will come along that we'll use again, and we're just accustomed to the idea of new technology changing our lives. But in 1968, this was an amazing thing, the way television was broadcasting what was happening around the world as it was happening.
Let me reintroduce our guest, and we have a couple of callers I want to bring into the conversation. We're talking with Mark Kurlansky. What we're talking about is his most recent book, which is titled 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. It's published by Ballantine Books. He's the author of a number of books. He's been a foreign correspondent. He's written about Spain, about Europe, about the Caribbean, and his work has been published in a number of papers, including the International Herald Tribune, Chicago Tribune. He's also written a lot about food. He is the author of the book Cod, A Biography of the Fish That Changed the World, and also Salt, A World History, in addition to a book about the Basque entitled The Basque History of the World, and a number of others. So if you're interested, you can head out and look for his books. And, of course, the newest one should be in the bookstore, 1968, Year That Rocked the World. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. First up, caller here is in Urbana, in line one. Hello.
Good morning. I have a couple of issues I was hoping the author could address. The first one is, I was born in 1972, so I wasn't around for any of the events of 1968, and I somehow made it through the U.S. educational system without really learning about these events. It wasn't until I started taking French in college and learning things more from a French perspective that I started learning about the importance of, they always talk about May 63 to May of 68. And
so you learned about Paris 68 before you learned about anything in the U.S.?
More or less, yeah. I mean, I guess I'd heard about different events but didn't know that they had all happened in 1968.
Right.
And we don't seem to have this kind of nostalgia that the French have for what happened over there in 1968, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts about why we don't see these events as being as important here, aside from our general lack of historical knowledge that we seem to have a problem with in this country. And then the other thing was, you were talking about people taking on the activities of the civil rights demonstrators here to fight for whatever it was that they wanted in their countries. And that's something that's really taken off in France. They definitely have a lot of demonstrations, even for things that it's hard to see, that would be difficult to change, that it would be very difficult to change. And here, we haven't had that kind of demonstrating, and it seems to be frowned upon by a lot of people and seen as unpatriotic, and I wonder if you have had any insights into that.
Okay, let me try to remember all this. I don't think it's true that the French have a nostalgia for 1968 and we don't. But the French, French 68, which of course, you know, 1968 in the U.S. was a culmination of years of activities, and in France it was a month long explosion. I mean, in most of the world in 68 things were going on, and absolutely nothing was going on in France until the spring. The French tend to look at their 68 or their May 68 as the beginning of the modernization of their country. Their country was in many ways still in the 19th century. It had a 19th century leader, Charles de Gaulle, who was 78 years old, and many of their institutions and many things about the country just hadn't changed. So to French people, it was a watershed year in a different sort of way. more about the social structure of the country than political change. They, in fact, failed to overthrow de Gaulle. I'm trying to remember what the other part of your question was.
It was about the fact, or at least the caller's observation, that perhaps in Europe, particularly in France, that people are more likely to go out into the street.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the reasons for that in France, I lived in France for a lot of years, and one of the reasons for that is that the French labor unions organize demonstrations and are able to turn out huge numbers to demonstrate on a variety of social and economic issues, and we don't have a system like that. We do have demonstrations, though. There were a considerable number of demonstrations against the Iraq War. Millions demonstrated.
That was very encouraging for me to see, because I had really been discouraged with the lack of public involvement in political life in this country, and it seemed like for a while there anyway, people were actually getting involved.
Yeah, and it was organized through the internet and in a lot of ways that that weren't around in 1968. And I think there's a lot of things going on in this country right now, and a lot of them are not all that visible because they are kind of on the internet. It reminds me of something Tom Hayden said. He talked about how in the early 60s he had traveled around the country and gone out to the West Coast. This was while he was editor of the Michigan Daily at the University of Michigan. And he wrote all these stories for the Michigan Daily about movements and student movements and all sorts of social and political things that were happening in the country. And he got back to Ann Arbor, and the faculty advisors said, you know, why are you writing this stuff? You're just making it up. This stuff doesn't happen. Nobody knows about this. But you're just, this is just a fantasy. But in another year or so, it became very clear that all of this stuff was around. And he suggests that, you know, right now may be a moment very much like that.
So in another year or so, or maybe between now and the presidential election, we could expect to see more of this type of thing?
It's quite possible. But if you think that we should, don't wait. Get to work on it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to line number two. This caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I want to ask a complicated question, but maybe we could put three dates as points on a triangle, and you could discuss them. You talk about 68 as the date that rocked the world, but what about 67 as having rocked the Arab world? And then maybe just we'll put the 2001 as the other point on the triangle, 67, 68, 2001. I guess what I'm curious about is Robert Kennedy was assassinated in 68. I guess there's also a controversy about whether he was actually killed by Sirhan Sirhan, a Palestinian Christian. But I'm just wondering if you can talk. It seems to me I was pretty much asleep. I was in high school at that time, or actually I was in grade school at that time. But I'm just wondering, it seems to me that 67 really wasn't on the radar of Americans very much, and I don't remember really much discussion of the fact that Sirhan Sirhan was a Palestinian, that he, and you know, what his motivation might have been if he did indeed assassinate Robert Kennedy. And then you have the war in Lebanon, you have various things going on in the Arab world, you have the New World Order. I'm just wondering, you know, and also about Vietnam and, you know, what happened with the occupied territories. Can you make any kind of connections? We weren't really talking about the Middle East in 68, but things were going on.
Yeah, well, that is certainly something that, Mr. Kurlansky, you deal with in the book as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, 67, of course, you know, all these things that happened in 68 didn't happen out of the blue. They just things led up to them. And 68 was a critical year in the Middle East, of course, because 67 was when the Six-Day War was. 68 was when Yasser Arafat emerged as a leader. And a lot of things began to change in the Middle East as a result of the Six-Day War. You know, it's funny, this thing that you mentioned about Serhan being a Palestinian. I have the same question. A lot was not made of it. I mean, we were told that he was not interested in Palestinian issues and had not been involved in Palestinian issues. We don't really understand, you know, and he's still alive and in prison. If he was the one who killed Robert Kennedy and he did it alone, I certainly don't have any understanding of why he did it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very strange thing. It has always been asserted that it had nothing to do with Palestinian issues, and there isn't any particular logic why the Palestinians would want to kill Robert Kennedy either. So,
I don't know much about Kennedy's war policy or relations to Israel in terms of support of Israel, but getting back to what's going on now, how do you relate this all to, for example, this backlash or the, quote, Republican Revolution, which seems to be, you know, a destruction of democracy and anything that was ever thought in the Enlightenment or in post-Enlightenment? It's a return to the Middle Ages. Well, anyway, what do you think about this backlash or this blaming of everything that's gone, quote, wrong in America on the people that were involved, for example, in protesting Vietnam and that kind of thing?
You had mentioned France earlier. This happens in France too. The far right in France claims that everything bad that's ever happened to France was caused by the students who demonstrated in 68. I actually think that in 68, I mean, this what you call the Republican Revolution happened in 68, and I think that this was the beginning of a lot of the bad things that happened in the U.S. So Richard Nixon completely reconfigured politics. He destroyed the liberal wing of the Republican Party. He fed into racism and fear, as has been the strategy of every Republican candidate for president since then. And, you know, it goes on, it continues. In 1968, Nixon saw that bigots were very angry about the civil rights movement, about the fact that the U.S. had finally, you know, righted some wrongs and made some progress in civil rights, and he saw that, you know, you could get those, there was a racist vote out there to be gotten, and also there was this fear that these demonstrations and that riots and all these things might go too far, and just a general uneasiness and fear that he was very good at exploiting. And you know, to this day, I mean, you see this with George W. Bush, who's basically saying that you need to re-elect him because otherwise the Arabs will get you.
We have, I want to thank the last caller. We have others. Let's go on to the next, and that's in Belgium by Danville, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. It'd be interesting to point out that during 1968, too, this whole malaise that you were talking about happening to the country was overlaid on a very robust economy that was just booming along, which was give every one of us baby boomers a very good life at that time. and also our parents, who were making good money at that time. But it is interesting that you bring up a lot of these things. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks for
that. You know, it's interesting that a number of people have said that to me, and it seems to be the way people remember it. And it's true about the economy of the 60s in general. But actually, by 68, there were a lot of problems with the economy, which had to do with the fact that so much money was being drained off for the war in Vietnam. It caused this huge gold crisis, and it caused huge problems in foreign exchange deficits. And Johnson in 68 was actually trying to pass laws inhibiting people from traveling abroad as a measure to keep foreign spending down, which was kind of absurd. I mean, the foreign spending was being done by him, not by tourists. But there were actually a lot of economic problems by 68 that were being caused by the war.
I want to. The caller makes me think of this fourth. I said at the beginning that you said there were these sort of four major factors that you can see going on here that helped shape that time, helped to.
But we never got to the fourth.
The fourth one. We talked about the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement. We talked about the increasing importance of television and sort of the immediacy of that kind of news coverage. The fourth thing did have to do with this emergence of a sense among younger people that they had their own values and that their values were different from their parents' values.
Yeah, people who were born after World War II, like myself, I was born in 1948, grew up with a sense that they saw the world in a completely different way than the people born before World War II. And what this meant was that there was this large young population coming of age that didn't really think much of the approaches of the people who were in charge. And this was true in Western countries, and it was true in the Soviet bloc, and it was true in, you know, emerging third world countries all over the world, partly because World War II had changed the world so much. And we really did grow up in a very different world than they did, and we saw things very differently. One of the huge impacts on us was the nuclear weapons. And I grew up in a world in which we were constantly being told about how at any moment somebody could push a button and life as we know it on the planet would disappear. And this was something that all of us, whether you were in the Soviet bloc or the Western bloc, all of us thought about it. It's the reason why people of my age didn't really think very much of the Cold War. The Cold War was an outgrowth of World War II thinking that to our minds was just going to lead to the nuclear destruction of the world. The Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember being terrified during the Cuban Missile Crisis and did not particularly admire John Kennedy's, what is come to be called his nuclear brinksmanship. I thought nuclear brinksmanship was insane. Who were these people, John Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, who were going to play poker and decide whether or not to blow up the world? And another thing that greatly influenced my generation was the Holocaust. All over the world, the Holocaust was seen as an example of what happens when there is not political activism, when people see things that are going wrong and don't do anything about it. And so there was this sense that you were obligated to speak out on things. And this was not a point of view of only of Jewish people. I mean, Mario Savio led the free speech movement in Berkeley, talked about this, about how the Holocaust taught you that you had to be politically active. And, And of course, it was a very strong factor in European movements and the German movement at a time where Nazis were still being found all over the government.
Let's talk with some other listeners here. Next is Aurora, line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I had two daughters that were political activists during that era. And I just wondered if I could say something about the parents and what the parents went through that were born before World War II. And then they had these daughters that didn't wear shoes to their graduation from college as a sign of how they felt about the war, had peace signs on their sleeve and on their mortarboards. And then I had a nephew that graduated from U of I, and he wasn't going to go to the graduation. And I said, well, I'm going. You're the first one in our family to graduate from a university. I'm going. So I went down there, and as you sat at the graduation and looked down, all these mortarboards had peace signs on the top of their on them, and you could see the activism there. It was stifling, and I never condemned it, but it was there, and it was all around you, and it was so difficult to say, well, I guess that's the way you feel, and just listen to them, and they were, as it turned out, they were right. I never knew how I felt about the war. I don't like war in general, and it was just a very difficult time for those, as you said, born before World War II, if you were bringing up children. Then I had two more children that went to college, and there was none of that. It went from the highest to the lowest as far as how they felt about what was going on in politics, etc. That's all I have to say, and I guess if you see your daughter going to the graduation, the university with no shoes on, you know, you just say, well, okay, go on, you know, but that's what they try to do in any way they could, show how they felt about things. Thank you for this.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, I think the caller raises, obviously, an interesting perspective, not one that you or I have, but that a lot of people probably listening would have.
Well, a perspective that I used to get from my parents. I don't know. I'll tell you, I'm a parent, and if my daughter speaks out against war, whether she paints it on a mortarboard or on her shirt or however she does it, I'll be proud of her. But one of the things that amazes me when I look back on that time is these grooming issues, why they were such a big thing. I mean, this obsession with hair length. Bobby Kennedy got all these letters saying, you know, if you're going to run for president, you better cut your hair. And in fact, when he did announce that he was running for president, he did cut his hair. And Joe Namath, who, you know, more than any single person is responsible for making football a national sport, would do these incredible feats on the field, and people would sit there in the stands with signs saying, get a haircut, Joe. And I really to this day cannot understand why people cared so much what length people's hair were.
Well, I think the other thing I think is interesting is the comments of the caller about how we have this peak of student activism and how quickly it seemed to drop off.
When the war ended. Yeah.
That there was nothing. That was the thing that galvanized people. And when the war was over, then there was no issue that could take its place. And very quickly, political activism, it seemed to really fell apart in this country on the left.
Yeah, and well, there were a lot of strange events. The 68 election, and to this day, it gets debated a lot. I fortunately was only 20 years old, and so was not entitled to vote in 68. Had I been able to vote, I don't know what I would have done, because both candidates were to me unacceptable. We had worked for years to get an anti-war candidate, and neither one were anti-war candidates. And people argue, I mean, I have this argument all the time. I was giving a talk in Washington, D.C. the other day, and one of Humphrey's speechwriters was challenging me on this and said that, you know, I mean, this country would have been so much better off with Hubert Humphrey as president than Nixon, and we wouldn't have had Watergate and all that. I think Watergate did a lot to stifle things, but and in hindsight, that's all true. But, you know, at the time, the thinking was, you know, that by not supporting Humphrey and not letting a Democrat in who wasn't really going to do the job, that opened the possibility of getting McGovern in the next election, who was the kind of candidate that we wanted. How are we to know that his campaign, which I worked on, by the way, would be, you know, a total disaster? And how amazing that it was a total disaster at a time when Watergate had already started to be exposed. But that the complete failure of the McGovern campaign and Watergate and a lot of those things that happened in the 70s contributed to this giving up on activism, not really on the political ideologies, but just on the activism.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers. I want to introduce again our guest. We're talking with Mark Kurlansky. If you're interested in reading more about 1968, you should look for his book, which is entitled 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. It's published by Ballantine. He began his career as a foreign correspondent. He wrote about the last years of Francoism in Spain. He also reported on international affairs from the Caribbean, Paris, and Mexico, and has written extensively about Europe and Latin America. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We've got somebody here on a cell phone. I want to get to them. Line two, right here. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to ask your impressions of some of the things that, that you've been talking about. It's interesting that the war casualties and death, some 58,000, but at the time, and I think that was a major factor, was what you mentioned, of why there was so much protest against the war. 2 million Vietnamese that were killed during this war, and at that point never was brought out yet. We still had quite a bit of demonstrations against the war. But I think a large point, and I was young at that age in college, and I think one of the main reasons we didn't like the war is the fact that we couldn't vote, couldn't drink, we could die, and the fact that there's a lot of students that just didn't understand the reason behind this war, and we still haven't had a lot of reasons why we fought the war, as looking retrospectively back. So I'd like your opinion on some of the thoughts.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I think that there's no doubt that the numbers of American casualties greatly contributed to the anti-war sentiment, and it's not coincidence that 1968, which was the year of the highest casualties, was when the anti-war movement really grew. But there were other factors about the war. I mean, the fact that the war, the whole logic of pursuing the war was a Cold War logic, and there were a lot of people who were just rejecting the whole notion of the Cold War, this idea that the Communist bloc and the Western bloc necessarily had to square off and be enemies was not completely accepted by people of my generation who, you know, grew up with nuclear weapons. I think that, you know, like the Iraq War, it was very shaky from the beginning. The Gulf of Tonkin incident that was supposed to justify it, it's never, to this day, it's not clear that it ever even happened. So the reasons for going to war were very much questioned. I would like to think that you know the world is moving towards us a world where people scrutinized and questioned much more whether we ought to go to war in any war.
Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana for another caller. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Mr. Kolansky, you spoke as if Democrats had championed the civil rights and Republicans had not. More Democrats voted against the civil rights bill than Republicans. President Kennedy was not eager to support civil rights because of the political problems that it would cause. It would cause in the South, Democrats in the South. And President Johnson is quoted, I know President Johnson did support the civil rights bill, but he's also quoted as making a comment like, there goes the South, or there goes the solid South. And he was right.
He was right.
Yeah.
Well, so it seems like the caller's making the point is that on the Democrats, it perhaps their support for civil rights wasn't really any stronger than was the Republicans. Do you think that that's true?
I mean, there were Republicans. I mean, the Republican Party was different in those days, and there was a liberal wing to it. And the first black senator was Brooke of Massachusetts was a Republican, and there was a lot of black support for the Republican Party, and it wasn't split up the way it is today. And the Democratic Party wasn't the party of the blacks, and all of the you know, the South was solidly Democrat, including people who were very anti-civil rights. It certainly was not at the time set up so that, you know, the Republicans were opposed to civil rights and the Democrats supported it.
Okay. That's all right. All I wanted to say.
We have about 5 minutes left, and one of the things that I guess I'm interested in having you talk about, because you make the argument that not only was this year important in and of itself, but that the things that happened in 1968 in some sense made us the people that we are even now. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure in which sense you mean, but do you mean politically or?
Well, I guess primarily I mean politically, but I suppose that there are some ways that you could argue culturally that it did that too. But maybe we should, since we don't have all that much more time, we should concentrate on politics.
Yeah, well, I mean political movements of the past 30 years have all stemmed from 1968, and the feminist movement and gay rights movements and the environmental movement really there are a lot of areas in which we have made progress in this country, and this came out of 68. It's not really true that everybody went home in 1970 and said, "Oh, forget it," and didn't do anything. The people who led these movements, such as the environmental movement and the feminist movement, came directly out of these movements and took these ideas of political action and applied them to these other issues.
We'll try to get one more caller in here in the couple of minutes we have left in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hello. The gentleman's call from Indiana, I think, deserves some comment. In 1965, we were seeing the end of a tremendous political shift. In 1900, both parties were dominated by liberals. But by the 1930s, the progressive liberals were shifting to the Democrats, while the Democratic Party still had almost all of the true conservatives. By 1965, those conservatives had shifted to the Republican Party and remained there, while the progressive liberals are largely Democrats. In fact, there are very few liberals left in what had once been almost entirely liberal, a liberal Republican Party. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, well, the liberal wing of the Republican Party was a huge factor in American politics right up till 68, and Nelson Rockefeller, who was a liberal, was considered the only Republican who had a chance of beating the Democrats in 1968, and ran this disastrous campaign in which he at one point announced that he wasn't going to be a candidate and did a lot of missteps, so that when the Republicans met in Miami in the summer of 68, Rockefeller was the one who had everybody's good wishes, and Nixon was the one who had all the delegates. And then it was widely believed that what Nixon would do is pick a liberal running mate, perhaps John Lindsay, the mayor of New York, who, interestingly, you know, was so liberal that New Yorkers today don't remember that he was a Republican. Nixon didn't pick a liberal. He picked Spiro Agnew. He had Strom Thurmond in 1968 had become a Republican, and he had promised him that he would pick somebody of his liking and to the liking of the anti-civil rights faction in the South, and so he picked Spiro Agnew. And this really was the end of liberalism in the Republican Party. There have been some somewhat liberal Republicans since, but they have generally been given the message from the Republican Party that they have no future.
We're going to have to stop, I think, because we've come to the end of the time. We certainly, there would be more that could be said, and I would encourage people, if you're interested in the subject, to go out and look at the book that we've been talking about. It's titled 1968, The Year That Rocked the World, by our guest Mark Kurlansky, and the book is published by Ballantine. And Mr. Kurlansky, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It was a pleasure to speak with all of you.
Yeah, thank you.